Old epigenetic phenomena that's been around for approximately 80 years now, in fact, and discovered by Novotny in the late 1920s, worked on a bit by Barbara McClintock in the 30s, and hopefully can show you that we're making some progress in understanding how this old epigenetic phenomena works. And what I want to tell you about today is our newest evidence on the mechanism for establishing this phenomena, which is in fact involving these siRNA-directed DNA methylation pathway that you actually have heard about from Karen McGinnis. She told you about siRNA-directed pathway, not so much about the end consequence of DNA methylation, but what Sean told you about as well, hinting at an RNA-directed DNA methylation pathway for repeats and transposon silencing, is in fact, we think, being used not just to silence the selfish DNA, but in fact the multi-gene ribosomal gene family, which I'll tell you about here. Okay, so just to remind you where we are in the cell. So here is a Nomarski image of a nucleus, and the nucleoli are the very prominent structures you see in here. And these nucleoli are where pre-ribosomal RNA assembly is taking place, and also a lot of other RNA processing as well. All right, what happened to my arrow? Sorry. Okay, here we go. Now, these nucleoli don't form at random, but in fact at very specific loci on the chromosomes. And in fact, Ron Phillips played an important role in showing this decades ago, that in fact, a very specific portion of the chromosome, which gives the secondary constriction at metaphase, is in fact the site where ribosomal genes are arrayed, long tandem arrays, in hundreds of to thousands of copies. And at those individual loci, the genes can be transcribed, and in this particular case, this is actually taken from a micrograph of yeast ribosomal genes to make the point. But you can see them being transcribed from the 5' end to the 3' end, and their RNAs are getting longer and longer off of the central DNA axis that's connecting them. Then within each one of these repeats, that's one after another, we have the coding regions for the three largest structural ribosomal RNAs and an intergenic spacer up here, which is in fact where all of the action is in terms of transcriptional control. And I'm going to be showing you today quite a bit of evidence that it's this intergenic spacer that's a hot spot for small RNAs that we think are directing, controlling the activity of these gene repeats. So what nucleolar dominance is this phenomenon that occurs in hybrids, whereby if you bring together two species which have active ribosomal RNA genes in the hybrid, one set of genes is repressed and one set of genes remains active. So this was discovered in plants, as I mentioned, back in the 1920s. But in fact, it's not a plant-specific phenomenon, but occurs in Drosophila and also in Xenopus species, in mules, for instance, the donkey. Ribosomal genes are dominant over the horse. And most recently, in some tiny little invertebrate marine copepods, this has been shown to occur. Now, if you're familiar with other silencing phenomena such as imprinting, one of the characteristics of nucleolar dominance is that there is no maternal or paternal effect. So it's always the same species genes get silent. It doesn't matter who is mom or who is dad in the cross. So that's different from imprinting-like phenomena. It's also not random. So unlike the exon activation that occurs in female mammals, eutherian mammals at least, and is responsible for the calico cat phenotype, where you get different pigmentation patterns from silencing different sets of genes and different clones of cells, that doesn't occur either in this phenomenon. So nucleolar dominance has some unique features, but is a very large-scale silencing phenomenon. So what we're our model system for most of our studies these days is Arabidopsis suessica, which is a not particularly well-known natural allotetraploid hybrid of the well-known Arabidopsis thaliana and a wild species Arabidopsis arenosa. And for most traits, the hybrid is intermediate. You can see that in the flowers, where arenosa has these nice large and purple flowers and thaliana these rather tiny little things. The hybrid's intermediate, and it's also intermediate in leaf morphology. But for traits like ribosomal genes, in fact, there's no intermediate phenotype. It turns out the thaliana ribosomal genes are silenced, even though there's over 1,000 copies of them, and the arenosa genes are on. And this was work done 10 years ago by Jeff Chen when he was a postdoc in the lab. And Jeff did this very simple experiment in which we took the hybrid seeds and grew them on petri dishes in which we had just growth media, like this, which would be the control, or included in the media an inhibitor of DNA methylation, which Sean introduced already, which is azadeoxycytosine, And or we could inhibit histone deacetylation with either triclostatin A or sodium butyrate, and that would be this next experiment. Or we could use both chemicals at the same time. So you'll notice that in the control condition, the aranosogenes are on, the thalianogenes are off. And so this is nuclear dominance occurring. If we block DNA methylation, we turn on the silent set of genes. Or if we block histone deacetylation, has the same consequence. And blocking both processes is no better than either of these others alone. And that was arguing to us that these things were somehow acting together in the same pathway. So 10 years later now, we take that for granted. But at the time, Jeff was one of the first to observe the fact that somehow histone modifications and DNA methylation go together in our partners. Another thing to notice in this figure is not only do the silent genes turn on, but notice that the dominant set of genes also upregulates. So I won't have time to get into this too much, but what this tells us, as well as other experiments, is that even the dominant set of genes is being dosage controlled. Not all of those thousands of ribosomal genes are on from this other parent either. And so some of them are on and some of them are off. And the ones that are off by the same mechanism that's silencing the other set of genes. So really what nuclear dominance is a manifestation of a dosage control system for controlling the number of active ribosomal genes. Since you have thousands of them, you don't use them all at any one time. So that's the rationale. What we don't understand is how it chooses one over the other. And what I want to tell you about today, we think, is getting after perhaps how it chooses through an RNA-directed pathway. Okay, so as I mentioned, what we could see is that we could not disentangle effects of DNA methylation and histone modification on the activation of the genes. So they seem to work in tandem. And diagrammed here, actually, is best we could do it from the artist's rendition, is that any change we make in DNA methylation in our hands has an effect on histone modification. Any effect we make on histone modification feeds back on DNA methylation. So we can't disentangle these things. They appear to be a circular pathway, at least in the case of ribosomal genes. So the non-artistic rendering of that model is shown here, and this is a bit complicated, but I want to walk through this because it's guiding a lot of our work. So we'd speculated back in 2004 a model whereby the chemical effects that we were seeing could be explained in a circular pathway. And if we start with something like DNA methylation that can be inherited after each round of DNA replication through maintenance methylation, so-called maintenance methylation, DNA methylation is a mark whereby there are specific proteins, methylcytosine binding proteins, can see that DNA and bind to it. In animal systems, at least, it was shown that these methylcytosine binding proteins actually form a complex with histone deacetylases. So the histone deacetylases now would have been recruited to the modified DNA, and now they start modifying the histones. One of the modifications you have to do is to remove acetylation from lysine 9 of histone H3. And by removing the acetyl group, you're able to put methyl groups on it, which is now a silencing mark. And then again, at least in animals, this methylated mark on lysine 9 is in fact the substrate for the binding of so-called chromodomain proteins. So chromodomain proteins like heterochromatin protein 1, discovered by my colleague at WashU, Sally Elgin, is the canonical member, founding member of this family. And HP1, for instance, interacts with DNA methyltransferases that could bring you full circle here. Likewise, plants have DNA methyltransferases with built-in chromodomains, so it's possible they could actually circumvent the need for a chromodomain protein in order to do the DNA methylation. So if we came in, according to this model, if we come in with AZDC and we block DNA methylation, that would have effects downstream on histone modification. Likewise, if we come in and we block histone deacetylation with TSA, that would feed around to having effects on DNA methylation. So this fit our results fairly nicely. Now, because we have some knowledge that, in fact, this is not some system that just evolved in case a hybrid were to occur in evolution, but is, in fact, the way dosage control is happening all the time to control the number of ribosomal genes that are active, this must be regulated to control that. So you must be able to switch from off to on. So we were speculating here several years ago that this loss of methylation would have to occur either actively by removing it through DNA glycosylases or by just by replicating multiple times without doing maintenance methylation. That would be enough to lose methylation and mimic the effects of a chemical demethylase. Likewise, going from the on-state to the off-state, we imagined would require de novo methylation. We'd have to take a gene that was missing it and put it on in order to silence. So I want to show you briefly, these predictions are coming true, that in fact it is the de novo methyltransferase that turns out to be critical. So the way we've gone about this is to use transgene-induced RNA interference. So we purposely make double-stranded RNAs matching the targets and then express these transgenes in our tetraploid species. So being a tetraploid, it doesn't lend itself very nicely to doing loss-of-function genetic screens because we have too many copies of the alleles. But RNAi is a dominant approach, which is nice. So it works very nicely in polyploids. So using that approach, so far we're finding things that fit that model that I showed you. And the data I want to show you today is that, in fact, a screen of the DNA methyltransferases has revealed that it's the de novo methyltransferase, DRM2, that matters. And we've also knocked down the family of methylcytosine binding domain proteins, and we've identified two that are critical, one of which is really interesting, and I'll show you why, and that's this one. And we've also previously identified there are 16 different histone deacetylases in Arabidopsis. We knocked them all down. Two of them turn out to be important, but these are already published, so I'm not going to talk about those today. I'll tell you about the unpublished stuff. Okay, so Sasha Proust, a former postdoc, now off at Monsanto, did a screen in which Sasha targeted all of the predicted DNA methyltransferases in the Arabidopsis genome to knock them down. So there's 10 genes, 7 of which are expressed, only 3 of which are known to do anything, and that's these 3. So we still don't know what the other 4 expressed genes in this family do. But anyway, he knocked them all down, and I'm just going to show you the results for the 3 that have known effects. So in Arabidopsis, MET1 is responsible for CG methylation primarily. CMT3 is responsible for C anything G methylation. And DRM2 is responsible for RNA-directed DNA methylation and can methylate any cytosine in any sequence context. So what I'm showing here are the wild-type control in each case is just a non-transgenic plant where the Arenosa genes, so the arrow over here is pointing to these guys, these are on. The Thaliana genes are only expressed in trace levels. Next door, we have 6 independent transgenic lines expressing double-stranded RNA to knock down the target. So you'll notice if you knock down MET1 in here, it really has no effect on turning on those silent Thaliana genes. Same with CMT3, but if in DRM2, in the various transgenic lines, there's varying expression from those lines and varying success at turning the genes on. But nonetheless, we do in fact de-repress the silent genes if we knock down this DNA methyltransferase. So Karen introduced this pathway, and I want to tell you a bit more about this RNA-directed DNA methylation pathway. So my lab was in on the discovery of RNA polymerase 4 in plants, and Pol IVa acts very early in the pathway, along with this RNA-dependent RNA polymerase 2, which is the MOP1 homolog in Arabidopsis. These two things make double-stranded RNA that can be diced by one of the 4 dicers in Arabidopsis to make siRNAs that are 24 nucleotides in size. And these 24 nucleotide siRNAs interact with Argonaut-4, one of 10 Argonaut proteins in Arabidopsis. And somehow, Argonaut-4, in conjunction with this piece of RNA, goes and it finds DNA that can match that sequence and lead to its methylation, and it uses DRM2 to do that process. Once methylated, there's various ways to maintain that through the 3 different possible DNA methyltransferases. But anyway, so it was interesting that in our screens that we had identified DRM2 as being important in nuclear dominance. There's another gene that's come from this pathway that seems to play a role, and that's the histone deacetylase HTA6, which we had previously found in a screen. So those 2 clues made us really start thinking that maybe there really is RNA, small RNA control of nuclear dominance. So we've explored that, and that appears to be true. So one of the first hints that we had is that good old Pol IVa, which gets this started. I guess we can still see this. In this case, if we localize where Pol IVa is in the cell, so these are the largest subunit and the second largest subunit of Pol IVa, which gets the process started. And those proteins are being localized here in an Arabidopsis nucleus stained with DAPI, so there's blue here. And the green speckles here are places where Pol IVa is concentrated in these very specific foci. We know what some of those foci are. They correspond to places where there are repetitive genes that give rise to abundant siRNAs. And some of those upon loci include the ribosomal RNA gene loci I've been telling you about, so the 45S ribosomal genes. So you can see that here where Olga Pontes in the lab has localized the ribosomal gene clusters by DNA FISH in red. So that's what these prominent loci are. The proteins are in green, and you'll note the very nice correspondence and co-localization of these two different subunits of Pol4 with these loci. Some of the other loci we know correspond to 5S gene loci as well, which I won't show you. And the rest of them, we don't know what they are, but they're presumably clusters of transposable elements elsewhere in the genome. So Pol4 is sitting on the scene of the crime. We've got the pathway. We're sitting right on our ribosomal genes. Moreover, there are very abundant siRNAs that are produced that match the ribosomal genes. So this in work done by Pedro Costa Nunes in the lab, Pedro made a series of probes spanning 300 nucleotides upstream and downstream of the transcription start site. And he did that for both the sense and the antisense strands. And just using these as probes to look for small RNAs, you see that they're very abundant 24 nucleotide siRNAs made in a region of about 100 nucleotides surrounding the start site. So from minus 50 to plus 1 is a real hot spot. From plus 1 to plus 50, not quite so much, but there are certainly a lot being made in this region. Now we've gone on to look at that more carefully using some more high-throughput sequencing data. And this is a data set provided to us from David Balcom's lab that Sarah Tucker in my lab has analyzed for the ribosomal genes. So these are color-coded. There are really four biologically relevant size classes of siRNA in Arabidopsis, ranging from 21 to 24. I'm not sure if you can see all the colors, but primarily what you get in here are blues and greens, 24s and 23s. So these are made by Dicer 3. So throughout the intergenic spacer, here's the gene promoter, and I showed you on a blot that that was a hot spot for siRNAs, and sure enough, that's reflected in these data sets where there is, in fact, a hot spot over the promoter. But in fact, throughout the spacer, there are very abundant siRNAs. Now, once you reach the coding strands down here, and if I showed you the next 7KB, it would look just like this. There's this huge amount of siRNA-sized things, but most of them are not, in fact, these biologically relevant sizes. They're other size classes. So they're undoubtedly degradation products of the really abundant ribosomes, and they're only on the coding strand. Whereas these small siRNAs that we find in the spacer are on both strands. So there's a real difference in what's going on in the spacer, being 24 and 23 nucleotide siRNAs on both strands, whereas once you hit the coding, it's just a mishmash of sizes and all from the coding strand. So something was going on here in the spacer. So also on blots, we could test the four different dicers for their effects. So now we're looking at that hot spot around the ribosomal gene promoter, in this case, for these very abundant siRNAs. And if we test the Dicer 1 null mutant, it has no effect. Here's a Dicer 2 null mutant, a Dicer 4 null mutant, but Dicer 3 really nails them. So it's clear that these really abundant siRNAs are coming from Dicer 3, at least at the promoter. And again, we can extend that now using these high-throughput sequencing data to extrapolate to the entire spacer. And if here we look at all of the spacer DNA, and this time using a data set from Jim Carrington's lab, that again, these 24 and 23 nucleotide siRNAs are the most abundant things in the spacer, and in a Dicer 3 mutant, they're severely depleted and very little effect on the few siRNAs of other sizes. So this entire spacer of several KB is a real hot spot for small RNA production. So we went in and we targeted this pathway, tried to knock it down now by RNAi. One of the beauties is that this particular dicer is not the dicer that you need for RNAi for knocking down other genes, so that it actually is susceptible to knock down itself. So making double-stranded RNAs that were targeting Dicer 3, we made transgenic lines and knocked these down. So relative to wild type, this is just three different loading controls of half X, 1X, or 1.5X amounts of RNA. And here, comparing four transgenic lines that would be comparable to the 1X level, you'll notice that there's very little production of that mRNA in these RNAi knockdown lines. And this is an internal control that's unaffected. So that if we test these transgenic lines for their effects on nucleolar dominance, it turns out that we've turned on the silent class of genes. So again, here's the wild type control where the Arenosa genes are on and the Thaliana genes are mostly silenced. And in these different transgenic lines where we've knocked down Dicer 3, now we've turned on the silent class. Okay, so very similar to the effects of knocking down the DNA methyltransferase. So in fact, without going through this in great detail, we have done bisulfite sequencing to look for regions where there are effects of methylation. And within the intergenic spacer, at sites that, frankly, we don't know their functional significance yet of these loci. But there are loci, such as this in the spacer, where there's clusters of methylation that is lost in the, if we knock out the de novo methyl transferase, we reduce methylation there. Likewise, we reduce it if we knock out players in this pathway for RNA-directed DNA methylation. So RDR2 or Dicer3, either one of those depletes the methylation at this locus. So arguing that, in fact, the methylation by DRM2 at these sites is directed by RNA coming from these other players in the pathway. Okay, so next little vignette I want to tell you is onto this question, okay, so if we have small RNA somehow directing methylation and that methylation is put on the genes, how is that interpreted? So we've gone in, we've knocked down the 12 predicted methylcytosine binding domain proteins in Arabidopsis. Two of them turn out to be important for nuclear dominance, and I'll just tell you about the one, MBD6, because it's the more interesting of the two. So same assay, wild type here, the thaliana genes are normally off, the genes derived from Arenosa are on. Whereas in independent transgenic lines in which we knock down MBD6, we turn on the silent class of genes. Now what's interesting, hopefully you can see this, is where MBD6 localizes. This thing really has a preferential localization right on top of the ribosomal gene. So again, there are 12 MBDs, and it looks like this one might be specialized for playing a really important role at the ribosomal gene loci. So we're localizing MBD6 in two ways here. One is a transgene where we've got a YFP tag on MBD6, and the other is just using antibodies raised against a peptide that matches MBD6. And both data sets agree in that you get a relatively limited set of foci where you localize MBD6, and these correspond to the locations of the NORs. So the green is where the protein is, the red is the DNA loci detected by DNA FISH for our NORs, and you see this beautiful co-localization of MBD6 with the ribosomal gene loci. And it's true using the native antibodies or the YFP locus. Now what's interesting is that in a DRM2 mutant, so here now we've shown that DRM2 is important for the silencing of the ribosomal gene loci. In the absence of DRM2 activity, this prominent localization of MBD6 with the NORs, so the conversion of the red and the green, doesn't happen anymore. Okay, so the idea is that DRM, so we identified both of these players in our screen, both MBD6 and DRM2, and so the idea fits the model that DRM2 is being directed to methylate the genes by RNA. Once methylated, that's the signal that MBD6 sees in order to bind it, so it requires the DRM2 methylation pattern somehow. So based on all that, this is the last slide, just to just bring that together in what we think is going on in switching states from the on to the off state for the ribosomal genes. And again, we think this not only applies to nuclear dominance, but even in a non-hybrid where, again, we're controlling the dosage of on and off ribosomal genes because we've got thousands of them, and during most points of the life cycle, we're not expressing all of them, just a subset. So in switching from on to off, we now think this 24-nucleotide siRNA pathway is important. Exactly how we choose one set of genes to silence in a hybrid and not the other, we still don't know, but this is an important clue that we're pursuing because finally, slight sequence differences that could be reflected in these RNAs might be enough to explain the choice mechanism. So we're pursuing this. But in any event, we certainly know that this pathway is important. I think that pathway is then directing de novo DNA methylation by DRM2. That DNA methylation pattern is interpreted by the binding of proteins that see that specific pattern, and MBD6 and MBD10 appear to be the two in Arabidopsis that are seeing this methylation pattern. At least in animals, methylcytosine binding proteins and histone deacetylases interact. We haven't shown that yet or been able to show that yet in Arabidopsis, but we have in fact identified two histone deacetylases out of the 16 that seem to be really important at the ribosomal genes, and that's this HCT1 and HCT6. There are a number of chromatin marks that I didn't bore you today with all of the chromatin immunoprecipitation experiments that we've done, but we know a number of marks that correlate with the on and the off states. So, for instance, putting two methyl groups on lysine 9 of H3, we know is a sign of the silent genes, for instance. Whereas a whole series of acetylation marks, the alternative, instead of being methylated on lysine 9, if you're acetylated there, or if you're acetylated on lysine 14, or at all four of these lysines of histone H4, all of these are marks of the onset that we've defined. Also, a different mark on histone H3, lysine 4 trimethylation. We know this to be a mark of the active gene. And we've also been able to show that we lose DNA methylation in the on state versus the off state. So promoters of on genes have less methylation, though we don't know precisely where, but they have less methylation than genes do in the off state. So this is the sort of the new insight, is that we've known about this means for silencing and for maintaining the silencing for a while, but what gets it started has been unclear. So it appears that that's coming through this small RNA pathway. The other sort of interesting take-home message of this is that we're used to thinking about this pathway being used to silence transposons and retro elements and things that are selfish DNAs we want off. But in fact, it appears that this pathway is being used to regulate even essential genes like the ribosomal genes that are present in multi-copies. And with that, I think I mentioned on the slides who was doing the work and some people that have left the lab that did important things. And most of this work actually is funded by NIH. And thank you for your attention. Okay, the question is whether we think 24 nucleotide siRNAs play a role in tRNA regulation, yeah. Is that right? I don't know, actually. I don't think anybody has looked. They undoubtedly play a role in 5S ribosomal gene transcription, and both tRNAs and 5S genes are transcribed by RNA polymerase 3. They also clearly regulate the ATSN1 class of retro elements, which are also Pol3 transcribed things with internal promoters that look like tRNAs or 5S genes, and they seem to be regulated, so it's possible. I don't know. Are they multi-family? That would be an interesting question, but not sure that anyone's investigated that. Yeah, Nathan.
So the silencing seems to happen in a lot of species. Mm-hmm. But MBD6 is kind of weird. There isn't a gene like that in a lot of animals and even other plants. So something else, is there another MBD that does that function, or are there just different ways to this process being made?
Yeah, I mean, MBD, so Nathan's asking about whether there are other MBDs in animals that might be playing similar functions. And that's a good question. So as far as I know, but nobody's really explored the MBDs yet. Well, I take that back. Actually, Sam Jacobs in human cells has identified that there are a couple of MBD proteins at least localized to the nucleolus. Now, I don't think they're the, when you draw, look at the trees, actually, so you've generated these trees of the MBDs and their associations. I don't think they're the closest homologs, but they're sort of nearby. And MECP2 is sort of like one clade away from MBD6 as well. Another thing is MBD6 and MBD5 are quite similar, and we're not entirely sure that we're not knocking down both, I guess, in our RNAi screens here. We're trying to make the double mutants of that right now in Thaliana to see if there might be a more visible phenotype. So I'm not sure. So it's possible, I guess, this long-winded answer, but it's maybe we're knocking down more than one thing by RNAi here, which may be explaining part of it. And to know, he's really looked at this sort of effect on silencing in animal cells yet to know if there is an equivalent. I suspect that there's something very similar, though. I mean, the work that Inger Grumpt has been working on, sort of the dosage control problem in mouse cells, and so far our data agree really nicely, actually, in terms of the two different systems of getting after the control of ribosomal genes. All of the same histone marks that we've described in plants are also the same things that happen in mouse, and the same interplay between histone modification and DNA methylation is the same. And in fact, we were just at a meeting recently, and they have some evidence that intergenic spacer transcripts are playing a role in the silencing of the genes. They don't know about small RNAs yet, but they're knocking down dicers based on what we've done, and my guess is they're going to find that what we're doing in plants is also true in mice and humans.
All right, thank you.